This is CISO to CISO, a live podcast focusing on information security, leadership, innovation, and more. Brought to you by Altitude Networks, data security for the cloud. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of CISO to CISO. My name is Michael Coates. I'm the host of this webcast. What a great show we have in front of you today. We're joined with Yasir, who I'll turn it over to in just a minute. But as you know from previous webcasts, we talk with wonderful CISOs from all sorts of companies all across the world to share tips, tricks, their backgrounds, how they got there, all sorts of wonderful things. Really a delight. This is brought to you by Altitude Networks. Very briefly, we are a cloud-native DLP, protecting data inside of platforms like G Suite, Box, etc. So if you're concerned about data in the cloud, offboarding, rogue applications, accidents, all of those things, that's what we're here for. So check us out at altitudenetworks.com. With that, why don't we get started? Yasir, so wonderful to have you here today. Just really great to pick your mind and hear your thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Great to be here.
So you've been in some amazing places. You were previously the CISO at Okta, the CSO at Splunk, and you've been at a variety of places before those. Tell us about your journey. How did you end up where you are today? Did you always know that you were going to be a chief security officer and that was your path through life, or how did you end up here?
Yeah, not really, but I think it's really hard to actually think about a point in time where I've decided to go to get into security. I think maybe it's something that started at a very young age. I've always been fascinated by technology and mechanics. I can think of a time where I used to completely dismantle or take apart the family VCR, for those of you who know what that is. Just before my parents come back from work, and sometimes I'll end up with a few spare screws and a few spare parts, but that's kind of a topic for a different time. But
it still worked. But the VCR still worked, even missing a few.
It did work somehow. I'm not sure how that happened, but yeah. Yep. I guess it was not very optimized. But fast forward a few years, I joined a group called 2600. And that is something that took place while I was pursuing my master's degree in computer science. And 2600, for the folks here who are familiar with the forum, used to exist, I'm not sure if they exist now, but used to exist at least in a number of forms. A virtual forum through websites, a published format, I think it was a monthly 2600 magazine that you could purchase or subscribe to, and then you had the gatherings in the physical world, and those used to take place every month. I believe it was the first Friday of every month, and what that gave me visibility into is this kind of fascinating underground world of hackers, and I became, as I mentioned, fascinated by all the discussions and interests that they had in different aspects of technology. I ended up joining Ernst & Young as an ethical hacker. So this is where I was able to join my passion to actually getting paid for hacking companies, which was at the time it seemed like the best job in the world. Mm-hmm. Yep. And at Ernst & Young specifically, I spent 11 years. and during those 11 years, I've done a number of things, including obviously pen tests, but also rolling out vendor security solutions, different types of assessments, compliance. And towards the end of my tenure with Ernst & Young, I acted as a consultant to a number of CISOs on the development and management of their security programs. After that, I joined Google. And at Google, I had a couple of roles. The first one was focused on the protection of corporate data. My mandates and scope were focused on all the G&A functions. So think about finance and IT and M&A and so on. And then after that, I joined the payments team. And payments is, at a time, at least was one out of seven product verticals at Google, including search and Android and social and so on. But payments was composed of two things. One is the payments infrastructure, which is how Google manages and the financial transactions pretty much for all the products and services. So we oversaw the security of that infrastructure. And the second aspect of it was the payments consumer products. You may be familiar with Google Wallet, Android Pay, and so on. So that gave me visibility into a number of things. One is managing security at scale. And Michael, obviously, you've seen this from your time at Twitter. It's one thing to manage security within the context of an enterprise or a small company, and it's a completely different thing when you have billions of user records that you are responsible for. So the amount of engineering that is and customization that is required in automation is completely different from the context of a small structure. The second thing is that was really interesting is the amount of which the security team, or at least members of the security team at Google, were specialized. They were deeply entrenched in very specific topics, and they could afford to spend weeks, if not quarters, digging into one specific area, like the firmware on, let's say, the motherboard that is used to power machines in the data center. It was just fascinating, right? And then the last thing is, as I mentioned, doing security for consumer products. That is also something that, you know, unless you are put in that kind of role, it has its own challenges, but also it has certain considerations that need to be observed. After Google, I joined SoFi. SoFi is a fintech company based in San Francisco. So now, instead of doing fintech for Google and having a kind of a slice of the pie in managing information security, now I have a 360 view of the entire security program, and I was able to manage it at SoFi. After that, I joined Okta, as you mentioned, as their chief security officer. And my role at Okta consisted of three things. One is managing the security program end to end. And the second was to act as the face of the Okta security to kind of all the external entities, including customers, investors, regulators, and so on. And the third one, which was somewhat interesting, is to chair, and this is a role that was added to my mandate after I joined Okta, I think after being there for about 4 months, is to chair the efforts to pivot into the security market. Now, Okta did an amazing job at catering to the CIO persona, but the task that I had on my hand was to essentially define the requirements and make sure that as a company, we meet the requirements and the needs of the CISO persona and the security team, obviously. What that entailed is work with the product team, with marketing, business development, partnerships, and so on. And that was a very interesting task, as you can imagine. And then as of January of this year, I joined Splunk. And Splunk is, as you know, they're a company, a great place to work. And right now, my focus is on driving a data-driven security program, if that makes any sense. It's fascinating the amount of focus that Splunk as a company has on leveraging and optimizing the use of data. So that's something that I think is keeps me challenged and keeps me looking forward to the next thing in the context of my role.
Yeah, wow, you've covered some ground. I really want to dig into a few of those things. I also wanted to mention or take a moment for those of you that are joining the webcast and can see where we're at. We're on virtual location again, and I skipped over where we are. Each show we're picking somewhere special to the guest. So Yasir, tell everybody where we are.
Yeah, this place is a tiny island in the Caribbean. It's called San Salvador Island. It's in the Bahamas. And the island, I think, has one resort and maybe a couple of hotels. That's it, pretty much. And it's just an amazing place. I think if there's one other place where I'd love to be, aside from being on this webcast, this is the place.
I don't believe that we're a close second to that at all. Yeah, it sure would be nice to be here for real. This, our virtual getaway is as good as it's going to get right now. Okay, so So some really incredible companies you've been at. And so you must have seen security really through a different lens in each of them or had a different flavor to the role. What does it mean to be a CISO at a basically a security company or a company that's selling a product to other security individuals? Do you find that that shifts the focus of your role? I mean, you mentioned a little bit about being the face of the company from a security perspective, but it must have entailed a variety of different activities from some of your other previous roles.
Yeah, so I think that's one out of maybe two aspects that is different from traditional industries, right? You are definitely expected to act as the face of the company towards everyone, everything that's external, all the external organizations. And that varies depending on the types of customers that you're pursuing. So for example, there is an expectation to be part of strategic deals and express to and articulate to your potential customers how you are going about being good custodian of their data, right? So a lot of times those interactions take place between security teams, but in some cases the CISO has to be there and they have to be the one to essentially commit personally to the fact that they will continue pursuing improvement in security posture and they have the right controls in place to protect the data. One thing that is interesting that I think is worth mentioning here is those types of interactions tend to be even more important when it comes to doing business in certain regions, in certain parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the interactions, especially with some Asian countries and cultures, the conversation is really not about security. It's about being there. It's about shaking hands. It's about forming those relationships. And it's about really about looking someone in the eye and say, yes, I am here to protect your data and I'm not going to slow down obviously I'll continue improving the security posture and so on. So it's about forming those personal relationships as mm-hmm. the cornerstone of trust. And I think that's an important thing that is good to mention here. Mm-hmm. The second aspect that I think is relevant for this conversation is the heavy involvement that you have with the product team. Specifically, what you want to be is customer zero. So you want to be the security team that dogfoods any kind of new products, new features, and provide feedback to the product team. So it is important to establish that feedback loop between security team and the product team. And part of that is to also, in addition to the feedback, provide them with access to information that we know about, things that are coming from the field in terms of changes to the threat landscape, trends, and so on. So establish that that communication channel that does act as a signal for the product team on how to orient fine tune as they continue working on the product roadmap. So we are customer zero at Splunk, and Splunk being a company that has, I guess one of the products is our SIEM. One of the things that we're expected to do is, have a showcase SOC, right? And share those best practices with our customers on how we use automation, how we use the SIEM to continue elevating our security posture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned automation a little bit earlier, and that really resonates with me as well. Like you mentioned, for me at Twitter, solving security in isolation is not as challenging as you'd think. Like there's a set control to apply to most risks and scenarios, but doing that at scale and with the facets of a fast moving business is a whole nother thing. How have you brought in automation? Like how are you thinking about scaling your efforts? So it's not just, more people to try and scale, which never works, but rather scaling something programmatically or operationally.
Yeah, I think it comes down to optimizing for speed and the best use of your resources, right? And when you think about that, there's a number of things that come to mind. Automation is the first one. So obviously, talent is scarce if you actually pursue in high performers. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when you have one, then the next thing that comes to mind is how am I going to be able to use them to their full capacity, but also how to keep them challenged and make sure that we, in this case, automate any kind of mundane tasks, right? There's obviously two school of thoughts. One is have an automation function, right, where that acts as a shared service to the rest of the security organization. And that uses standards tools and so on to deliver on automation requests and requirements from the rest of the function. And second is to have embedded automation engineers within each one of the teams that require this kind of transition. What I've chosen to do, I have a little bit of a different approach that I'm taking right now as Splunk compared to Okta, is to have a hybrid model where we have both an automation team and also engineers that are embedded with the teams that require kind of a heavy lift, but also somewhat of an expertise in the domain. An example would be automation engineers that are embedded within the IR team or within the detection team. So those are some things that I think would be helpful in the context of that topic. The next thing I would say is it is important to have in your bag of tricks a SOAR technology that is best of breed and that allow you to speed up some of the work that is involved in automation. So to the extent that, for example, you have a SOAR tool that is integrated with a number of your vendors, right, out of the box, again, that shortens that cycle of going from an idea to actually implementing something and deriving value.
I agree. And it's fascinating you mentioned the embedded model. I see a lot of security programs using a security champions style approach to either deputize someone who's already in the team with security responsibilities or put someone from security team in there from almost a subject matter expert perspective. But what I'm hearing from you is you're doing that with a twist that they're an automations specialist, but they still bridge that security gap. So they know what matters from security, if I'm hearing that right, and they help you automate your pursuit of it. Is that right?
Exactly. So we actually do that with a number of, I could just call them specialties at this point, right? So I have automation engineers and I have folks who specialize in analytics and also machine learning. Machine learning right now is heavily used in the context of SOC operations, security operations, to specifically to further the threat hunting program. But it does exist as its own function, and anyone in the security team can call on this function and kind of have a discussion on whether they're going to be able to leverage those skills and those capabilities to further their and speed up the path they will need to take to attain their objectives.
Yeah, that's really cool. I like that. That's neat. So with consideration of the world and the time that we're in, maybe this will be all long and forgotten if you're watching this recording years from now. But we're in the midst of a global pandemic, the midst of COVID. How do you think that's going to impact security? What does security post-COVID or continued COVID, what does that look like? Are we returning to the office? What does that change from our technology and our security thinking?
Yeah, so my perspective is that we are embarking on what I call the new normal, right? And my rationale is that a lot of us in the security community and actually beyond the security community, pretty much every professional, have been historically skeptics in terms of can we attain the same level of productivity and team collaboration when it comes to work from home. Now we have this current situation where, in fact, it actually forced us to work from home. And what we've noticed as security practitioners, but also at the company level, is a number of things. And frankly, a lot of them are just win-win for everyone who's involved. From a employer perspective, obviously we've been seeing a an increase in productivity, right, from the employees. The second thing is, I think employers are seeing maybe a drop in cost when it comes to facilities, travel, and so on. So that's definitely a win for an employer. On the flip side, for the employee, I don't have to spend as much time commuting. I can spend more time with my family. I can be more productive. I can be more social while delivering on my mandate. So again, I think this is a win-win situation. And coming out of the current pandemic, and which I hope is gonna be fairly soon. I can't wait, as you can I can see. But I think we'll be in a new normal from a working model perspective, and that new model would be characterized by kind of a shift of that ratio between employees that are working strictly from the office and those that are working remotely. And I think it's going to tilt towards the remote work. So from that perspective, I think as CISOs, as security team, we need to consider the impact on our day-to-day jobs. My team has been, I would say, fairly early in recognizing the trend. And we have conducted a risk assessment or threat assessment. This is a threat in an intelligence team resulted in a number of insights. One is there is a number of risks that we need to pivot and prioritize compared to the previous model. And those risks can be thought of as, one is attacks against the endpoint. Now that the employee is no longer protected by the corporate firewall, we need to concentrate as many of our security controls in that endpoint. What that means practically is a strong EDR, but also the ability to do things like respond to incidents more effectively as they happen, as they take place and impact the endpoints. The second thing is obviously phishing, right? We're not the only people who think about the impact and the opportunity that the current situation represents. The thing that's actually interesting is that there has not been really a change in tactics, right? The phishing tactics and the social engineering tactics are exactly the same. It's just the theme that has changed. I would say even that the volume of phishing attempts is somewhat similar than what we've seen before, but now all of a sudden everything is COVID themed, right? So to counter that, obviously we want to have an anti-phishing solution coupled with a communication campaign to make sure that our employees are aware of the current threat landscape and then they're able to effectively protect themselves. Alongside of phishing and social engineering, some attempts to lure the employee into accepting MFA requests where they don't originate from them actually trying to authenticate. And I think what's important there is to partner with a strong security vendor, one that offers MFA solutions that are context aware. If the MFA request is originating from, I don't know, some place in Asia, while the employee is in the US, then that should be blocked automatically by the MFA provider. Now, at a minimum, the employee should actually see information about the origin of that request so that they can make an educated decision on the spot. The next thing that comes to mind is corporate data spillage. Obviously, a lot of our employees, I guess some employees in this case, will be tempted to use personal devices to access corporate resources and data. And what that means is a risk to that corporate data, whether it's from the perspective of the employee still working for the company and potentially that personal device being compromised. But also when the employee leaves the company, they can maintain access to that data, which is obviously a different type of problem. From a solution perspective, what we have decided to accelerate is kind of a zero trust agenda where we want to tie identity to to the hardware that is IoT managed. So from that perspective, if you try to authenticate or come in from an IT managed laptop, you can get access to the systems and resources that you typically have access to. If it's a personal device, then that scope will be reduced dramatically to the extent that we can limit access to sensitive information. And then the last thing that, that came out of that exercise is the risk of malicious public network. I think after we kind of, you know, someone discovers a vaccine and so on, we go back to the real world. I see a scenario where a lot of our employees would be working out of cafes and public settings and so on. So I think it is important now to make sure that our endpoints are hardened to the extent that, you know, you can rely that the endpoint will remain secure as much as that's even a term of being 100% secure. Mm-hmm. It's not exercise, but to remain as much as secure as possible in the context of a public setting. The last trend that we started talking about is not necessarily in the context of Splunk, but our customers, is this acceleration of the move to the cloud. A lot of the companies that have been sitting on the sideline and thinking, okay, well, we will maintain higher level of security by managing our systems and applications on-prem. Now they're facing a situation where they had to multiply their VPN capacity by, you know, 5x, 10x, right? And that VPN becomes the single point of failure, which is obviously not acceptable to a CIO or a CIO. So if they want to maintain their job. And I think this is a situation that calls for certain questions about, okay, well, what if really, how secure is the cloud? Can we actually make it secure, right? And does it make sense to diversify and hedge our bets when we think about the availability of our systems? And as we accelerate the migration to the cloud, what that will translate to is an exponential increase of the log volumes that are going to be available to SOC analysts to sift through, right? Hence my mm-hmm. you know, the previous discussion around, you know, SOAR, the importance of having this a best-of-breed SOAR technology and automation. So that those are some things that came up in the context of that analysis that we performed.
Yeah. Yeah, that resonates a lot with many of the things I've been observing. I think some of the immediate impacts on visibility and applicability of controls is really interesting to dig into. Because like you mentioned with VPN, you either have to massively increase its capacity or shift to like split tunneling. And if you shift to split tunneling, then all of your internal monitoring controls are no longer applicable, because half the traffic or more is not even necessarily going into your network. So that realization of what works and what doesn't, or if you go the other way and say, well, we'll do full tunneling, but then your VPN is a single point of failure. Those are some new, you know, real challenges to think about. But yeah, and I'm glad when you mentioned public Wi-Fi hotspots. You know, they sometimes get thrown around as like this voodoo thing. You see them in some of the generic news articles about watch out for public Wi-Fis. And I think we all read them and are like, tell me exactly what you're concerned about. And I think you got to what actually is the concern, which is if the device is in a potentially hostile network, whatever that is, it has to be secure. And totally agree about that. Yeah, fascinating. Well, yet to be seen how long we're in this reality. And I think, as you mentioned, there will be a new normal, which will be different. Hopefully better in some ways, but nonetheless, a moment to reflect and change. Let's see, I'm gonna pull in a couple questions from the audience. We have a few more lined up to go through, but I wanna pull in a couple of theirs too. All right, let's bring this one in. So how do you explain to senior management and the board the value that the security function brings to the company? The old, how do you talk to the board?
Yeah, that is a really good question. Mm-hmm. So I think to answer that question, we need to start from the perspective of the board mandate. Essentially, what is the board supposed to be doing and the value that they're adding to the company and to the shareholders? The board is, to a large extent, there to manage risk, right? And as we progress, as an industry or from a technology perspective, and we see how much of our day-to-day work is reliant on technology, how much every company now has to become a technology company, if not, they'll just, you know, disappear pretty much. So it's that heavy reliance on technology that makes it essential for us to continue investing in information security. So now, you know, information security is no longer seen as a tax, right? It is a way of doing business. It is a way to support the business, to accelerate business, but it is important in how we do our day-to-day work. The risk aspect of it is obviously relevant in the context of this conversation. And the board, whether they have picked on this trend early on, or they are responding to regulatory pressures, has to assess the risk of the company from a information and cybersecurity perspective. Hence the interaction with the CISO, right? I think a few years ago, it used to be that interaction for the most part used to take place from the board into the CIO or maybe the CTO. And I think right now the board needs to hear it in the audit committee, that they need to hear it directly from the CISO. What to cover in the context of that conversation, it really depends, it varies from one company to the next. And at the core of the topic maybe is to understand what your board cares about and to have those conversations early on, to socialize your approach, have a proposal, come in with, you know, frameworks and so on, but know that if you don't cover anything, you have to cover the risks that you are currently managing. And it is not an answer, or it's not, at least it's not advised to go into that kind of those kind of discussions with risks, but no mitigation plans, right? A lot of the work, a lot of the negotiations, a lot of the planning and strategizing that that revolves around mitigations has to take place before you have a conversation with the board. If you go in with doomsday is near and so on, that's not going to go well, right? The board expects you to understand your scope, have a good control over your scope, your risks, but also have a robust plan on how you're going to mitigate those risks. The last thing I think that is worth mentioning is you don't want to go into those discussions with disagreements, right? Again, a lot of the conversations around, hey, when are we going to do this? Priorities, funding, and so on, a lot of that has to take place before you go present to the board. It has to be crisp, it has to be concise, and it has to be a presentation that caters to the interests of your board specifically.
Yeah. Yep. I think your note about the presentation of the board is not the first time they're hearing it. I think that's spot on. You've talked to them ahead of time. You know how they're thinking. They're prepared. They're not being surprised. You come with answers and plans. I like that. Very cool. Okay. So kind of a quick one. What would you recommend in terms of books or podcasts for those looking for that next nugget of great information? Anything that comes to mind?
Yeah. One that actually comes to mind is a book called Scrum, and you can see the link to some of the earlier topics that we addressed. So Scrum by Jeff Sutherland, and essentially it is about adopting the Scrum methodology to projects that do not necessarily fall in the context of software development. I am very much passionate about optimizing things. I think that's pretty much one thing that I'm really interested in. And Scrum just gave me those answers, right? And what that is essentially a methodology of optimizing the delivery of projects while allowing for the team to self-organize and to learn from their mistakes and to continuously optimize and improve as they go. but it's about doing that in a much smaller cycle than your typical waterfall project. I think all of us have been in situations where we have planned a project over the course of months, quarters, if not years, right? And by the time we finished planning, it turned out that a lot of the assumptions that we've made are actually false, right?
Yep. Classic waterfall.
And we end up re-leveling and resetting the project multiple times and so on. And to me, that actually translates to waste, right? Yep. What Scrum calls for is this approach to consistently deliver and iterate on the product. So anytime you finish those biweekly sprints, you actually deliver a product that is capable of adding value, and that is that does not necessarily have dependencies of the work that's going to be executed in future. The other thing that it does is that it allows you to continuously focus on the highest priority items. When you think about a sprint, it's 2 weeks. There's just so much work you can do on 2 weeks. And so part of the discussion in the Scrum and the sprint planning is to identify those highest priority items. And those are typically the ones that I get tackled for. So at Splunk, we have been piloting the Scrum methodology in one team. And I think if everything goes well, we'd like to actually use that as the way to plan and execute work going forward across the board within the security team, obviously.
Yeah, I've really been a fan of that thinking as well. And I think being in engineering focused technology organizations, you see that they've adopted that and you say, wait, we can adopt this for other things that might not be on a development cadence, but still apply the same way. We could talk about it at length, but I've done a bunch of, you know, thinking about OKR structures and how they have many benefits, but they also have a lot of pitfalls on that longer horizon. And while a Scrum and an OKR are, of course, thinking about things at different levels, that short horizon really forces you to say, like, how do I make the most impact right away versus, to your point, like waterfall, like talking the thing to death for 18 months and then realizing everything shifted under you. So that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Okay, so last item here. There's a lot of people that are thinking about getting into the field of security or maybe aspiring to lead security as a chief security officer one day. What is your advice for that next generation of security folks?
Yeah, I mean, and this is my personal opinion, obviously, but I think this profession is about passion. So if you're passionate for security, if you like to break things and maybe defend, it depends what your motivation is, but it is, you have to really be passionate about your job. I think that's a good place to start. If you're not passionate about security, then you're in for a treat. It's not always easy. Mm-hmm. And there is a number of avenues that one can kind of look into in terms of how to get into a career in security. And those avenues can vary from, you know, risk and compliance, could be security operations, AppSec, and so on. But the bottom line is that there's not one answer in terms of how to get into information security. Once you're in it, if you're passionate, it's very rewarding. And I think you will wake up every day thinking, okay, this is the best day of my life. And I'm actually excited about going back to work. Not in the COVID context, but maybe go into my office and get on Zoom. To address the question of CISO or no CISO, I think maybe it comes down to, are you passionate about everything under security, or is there a specific discipline or topic that is more interesting to you than the rest? Mm-hmm. If it's the latter, then I recommend that you pursue the IC career path, individual contributor, and you can have a really good career as an IC. And the more you specialize, the more obviously you're good at what you do, the more demand there's going to be for you, you know, within the context of your company or organization, or, you know, from a career perspective, you choose to move on to your next organization. If you are like me, someone who just cannot let go, who was interested in everything, then definitely the CISO career is one for you. That's for you, right? It allows you to have that 360 degree visibility of everything security. It is, as I mentioned, both rewarding and challenging because you actually spend your time, well, a lot of your time, negotiating and removing hurdles for your team and so on. And the other thing that you realize is that as a security team in general, the odds are somewhat stacked against you, right? You are outnumbered when you think about the ratio of defender to attacker. And from that perspective, it is a challenge because to use the analogy of a castle with 1,000 windows and that is constantly, you know, being built and new windows are being added. And which one you secure first? Do you secure by closing windows or are you going for a threat hunt and look if there is someone who actually already inside your environment? Mm-hmm. When you think about it in the cloud context, well, those castles, now it's no longer just your castle. Now you have to protect data in additional castles that don't even know. So anyways, it can be pretty challenging. The second aspect of the challenge is that you may be thought about as someone who, or the security team in general, someone who is slowing down the delivery of the product or the business, right? Someone who's adding friction. And those are fairly challenging conversations to have, but they come back to the culture of the company, right? And if your company values security, then it's kind of straightforward. If there is a tone from the top and everyone along the organizational hierarchy values security, understand why you're there for, and obviously it is embedded in the mission of the business, then you have your job cut off for you. But other than that, it can be pretty challenging. So that said, I think it is a very rewarding career. I don't think I would have done anything else if I was to do this from scratch. Mm-hmm. So definitely recommend it for everyone who's interested and intrigued by a secure career.
That's awesome. Yep, passion. I agree with you. Passion matters a bunch. That's for sure. Well, this was great. I really appreciate all of your time. Fantastic thoughts and ideas shared with everyone. Thank you everyone who joined live. Thank you to those who are watching this recorded version afterwards. But we'll come to you again in future weeks with other CISO webcasts. So make sure to check us out. We announce those on the LinkedIn page. And again, this is brought to you by Altitude Networks, protecting data in the cloud and cloud applications. So check us out if that's of interest. And again, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Really awesome talk.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Thanks.